back to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. We're having a conversation here about COVID-19 and where we stand with it. I am going to be joined in just a moment by a behavioral data scientist. I'm so excited to have Mr. Charles Davis on the show. Let me go to the two calls that we're holding on before I introduce Mr. Davis. We have Mona on the line. Mona, thank you for holding.
Hi, how are you doing, Dr. K?
I'm doing well. Thanks for calling.
Good. And before I start, and I'll be quick, I want to say that I have a medical technology degree from the Morgan State University, and I have a master's degree in cyber forensics, a master's degree in information assurance, and a master's degree in e-business, and I'm about to get one in cyber security, and a PhD in cyber psychology.
Okay.
So I said all that to say that there are some people that have made a sound decision based on a risk analysis for them to say, hey, I'm not going to get this vaccine. One, and either way, you know, people do what they do for sound reasons. One, that I'm not taking it is because I'm allergic to one of the ingredients. And some people don't even know what all the ingredients are. One of them is sucrose. I'm allergic to that.
Okay.
Another reason would be, for me, that a lot of people got fevers and when they got after the vaccination. If I got a fever, it increases my risk of having a seizure. I've only had one in my life. But the last time I had a fever was 30 years ago.
Okay.
So people could say, well, you might get a fever at any time.
Right.
So, but based on that risk, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not going to do it because then I'd be putting myself in more harm. So there are other reasons that people that don't take the vaccine. It's also health reasons.
Okay, I appreciate
and,
that. Yes, Mom.
Wait, can I tell you one more thing?
Sure.
But I know my status. So I have like 20 Abbott tests. You know, I always test myself, the home test.
Okay.
And I have and I go and get the antibody test. If I could pay somebody, because I'm trying to get somebody to take that antibody test, I go and I'm always negative. It's a way to show that you have antibodies from a person who has taken a vaccine.
Right.
If you have antibodies, you should have some. I know they say that's not, you shouldn't, you know, really rely on that, but they have mm-hmm. the tests out there. If I could pay somebody that has had the vaccine, I will, you know, I'll pay for it. It's only $25.
Okay.
And that will help me. I still won't take the test,
right.
But maybe if it's approved and so, you know, I'll pay for it. So
okay.
If you could get anybody on the line.
Okay, if anybody does call. Thank you so much, Mona. I think we should bring in Mr. Charles Davis. He's regarded as a pioneer in the area of behavioral biometrics and computational behavioral modeling and data science. He is an outspoken proponent in the development of ethical, diverse, and socially responsible applications of artificial intelligence and machine learning. I asked Mr. Davis, Chuck, to come on the show to speak with us about the different variants, to speak with us about the data analysis work he's doing, about the prediction modeling he's doing, and what he has seen firsthand in his work with COVID-19. Chuck, how are you, sir?
Good, good. Thank you so much, Dr. K, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for coming. Can we begin by just having you talk through the different variants? Now, I put that out there because I had read that someone said, imagine that you run, you know, a 13-minute mile and that someone passes you running an 8-minute mile. They're like, last year's COVID-19 is a 7-minute miler. The Delta variant is like a 6-minute miler. And the new variants are running like 3 and 4-minute miles. Like, you're not going to be able to catch them if you are unvaccinated. So can you talk about the different variants that are out there and where we stand with COVID-19 today?
Sure. So the different variants, and let's first just get into the definition of what a variant is and understand, I want your listeners to understand, I'm not an epidemiologist, and I'm not a virologist. I'm a data scientist, but I'm hired by counties and states and work with various government agencies because my job is to look at data. There's a behavioral component to this, and that's what I specialize in, which is looking at all the data, figuring out what people are doing, what they're going to do, what the virus is doing, and how it will impact people going forward. And a lot of the predictive models that I've worked on have been very, very accurate. So, that's been very helpful. So, those organizations use the work that I do for their planning. With that being said, let's talk a little bit about variants. There's a saying that viruses live to mutate and mutate to live. If you have a virus that is spreading and active within the community, it will mutate. So a virus's only job in life is to make copies of itself within a cell. That's all it does. It doesn't do anything else beyond that. And the problem is, in the process in doing that, it winds up destroying the cell. And then you have, this proliferation of virus. And so it's making these copies and over and over and over and over again. And eventually what happens is it will make a mistake. It will make an error in the copy. So it's like having a copy machine where you're making lots and lots of copies and there's one that's flawed. That's a variant. Most viruses and a variant is not necessarily a bad thing. A lot of times it weakens a virus. But every once in a while you'll get one that evades some of our protection or makes it more transmissible. So it's kind of like a survival of the fittest. Lots of different variants, and a particular variant will outrun the original virus. So right now, the way that the CDC looks at this data and classifies variants are there are variants of interest, and then there are variants of concern, and then there are variants of high consequence. And each one is progressively worse. The worst one is the variants of a variant of high consequence. Currently, we don't have a variant of high consequence, but we do have variants of concern. These are changes within the virus that tend to make it more transmissible, and or tend to make it where you get sicker. In that respect, there are four that we're currently looking at, which is the Alpha variant, the Beta variant, the Delta variant, and the Gamma variant. The Delta is what everybody is focused on right now. That particular variant came out of India. We had a lot of people, as you might remember, that got sick in India, and India has a large population. So when you have a large population with a lot of replication, then you have a higher chance for mutations. And we even have mutations within the United States. We have a New York variant. We have a California variant where we had, large populations of people that got COVID. But the Delta variant is concerning because we're actually calling it a double mutant because it has two distinct features. One is it's easier to catch. It's more transmissible. And the other thing is that it's more virulent. And what we mean by that is that Delta produces 1,000 times more viral load than the original COVID. And so the problem is that new and improved version of COVID, if you will, that's why it's spreading so rapidly, and that's why you're seeing people that get sick. The previous caller had mentioned, if I heard her correctly, she talked about the viral load and a couple of other things. The issue is with Delta, and by the way, I agree with her. People need to make up their own minds about becoming vaccinated or not becoming vaccinated. My goal is to make sure that. And as is yours, to make sure that people have all of the information so they can make an educated decision. The issue is you probably could have gotten away, you know, shouldn't have, probably could have gotten away with not getting vaccinated with the Alpha strain. But this new Delta strain that's kicking up is a whole new deal, and people need to rethink their calculus around how safe they are. This is affecting younger people. Like I said, 1,000 times more viral load makes it more transmissible and potentially more virulent. And it's being watched very closely because there's a possibility that, as it stands now, it's a variant of concern. But there are subvariants of this known as AY1, AY2, and AY3. Mm. We have the potential for Delta to become a variant of high consequence. And that means that if that happens, or if we get another mutation above and beyond, that's when effectively your vaccines are not working, or not working to the degree which they are now. And the vaccines are extremely effective right now.
Right, because if I'm not mistaken, they said 99.7% of the people, and I got these numbers from you, 99.7% of the people who are in the hospital right now are unvaccinated. The vaccines are working. But here's what my concern is, Mr. Davis. If I am vaccinated and I'm around people that are not, what are the chances that I'm going to end up with a mutation that maybe my vaccine is unable to hold? What they call this escape variant.
Right. So, I mean, that's a great question. Right now, like I said, we don't have any variants that have been classified by CDC as of today as being a variant of high consequence.
Okay.
That could change. So, you know, we can't necessarily worry about what may happen in the future. We kind of have to deal with the here and now. Here's what we do know. Delta is active. It is spreading rapidly. The growth is moving from, right now it's incremental growth, but we've seen this before. We could just look at history. We know the story from going from incremental growth to exponential growth. And so you bring up a good point about mask wearing. That's definitely something I want to address. If I'm vaccinated and you're vaccinated, right, then why do I need to wear a mask? I mean, we just heard just a few weeks ago,
right,
we don't need to wear our mask if we're vaccinated. And that's part of the problem. We have a couple of problems here, and a lot of it is messaging, right? This conflicting messaging that we're getting from you know, from our government officials and our medical professionals. And in all fairness, it's because the landscape of COVID is changing. The virus is mutating, it's changing, you know, it's adapting. And so as a result, you know, we have to kind of adapt with it. The real issue is, if I'm wearing a mask, I'm wearing a mask to protect other people.
Right.
I'm not wearing a mask really to protect myself. If I'm vaccinated, there's a chance that I can have a breakthrough infection and wind up potentially requiring hospitalization, even though that's extremely unlikely if I'm vaccinated. And even with most breakthrough infections, what we're seeing now is that the majority of people are actually asymptomatic. We've seen it at people at the Olympics that's now starting to get a fair amount of coverage, where a lot of these athletes, they're actually asymptomatic. They wouldn't have known if it weren't for the fact that they were getting tested and they're fully vaccinated. The issue there is they're not getting sick to the point where they need to go to the hospital or dying. And that's really what the promise of the vaccine is. No one ever said that the vaccine was 100% effective and that you would not get COVID. And I think that's what people thought.
Right.
Again,
okay.
Probably poor messaging. But by the same token, you know, that's what you're wearing a mask for. You're wearing a mask because there are people that are unvaccinated. There are people under the age of 12 for which they can't take the vaccine at all. And you have the potential of being asymptomatic,
okay,
still getting COVID, not showing any signs at all, but yet potentially passing COVID on. We don't know that for certain because the jury's still out, the data's still being examined, on to what degree people that are vaccinated but have asymptomatic COVID as a breakthrough to the degree that they can pass it on. But why take the risk?
Well, let me ask you this. What about schools? Because we know that in short order, schools are going to be opening up. There are quite a few places that will not put in place a mask mandate. But the American Association of Pediatrics said, look, we think everyone over the age of 2 should be vaccinated. Again, these are mixed messages. But when you look at the data, how should we plan for our children, K through 12th grade, and then our college students going back to school?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and you're right. The American Academy of Pediatrics is now recommending that any child over the age of 2 wear a mask. Children, under the age of 12, still there's no approved vaccine for them. But with that being said, kids have to, it's rough. They have to social distance. We've been extremely lucky that. For the most part, younger people have done pretty well with COVID in terms of hospitalization and illness. My concern is that, again, if we're not controlling the spread of the virus, that we will eventually get a mutation that will target young kids. It's interesting. And again, I definitely want to answer the question, but the only thing that we could do right now to keep our kids safe is to ensure that they mask up and follow proper social distancing, and hope that others do the same. If we do it collectively, then that's our best way of keeping safe. But this argument for vaccination, it's interesting because. My grandmother used to always say, the only thing new in the world is the history you don't know. It wasn't until I got older that I realized that that was actually Harry Truman that first said it. But the point is that we've seen this before with polio. I mean, people got the polio vaccine because we saw how devastating it was to children. And so there wasn't this hesitancy and resistance. I think because this virus has not really affected clinically our young kids as much, we're far more willing to kind of play a little bit loose. But I think that the minute that COVID starts, taking the lives of young children, God forbid, I think that would cause a very, very different assessment.
Let me ask you this, because I know we don't have much time left. So fomites, we know that was a big thing in the beginning. You had to sterilize everything, wipe everything down. Well, some people are kind of social distancing. Some people are sort of masking up. Should we still be, now I believe we should be washing our hands all the time anyway, but I'm saying to the extent that we were wiping everything down, particularly with our babies here.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that just makes good sense anyway. Again, I go back to my grandmother, she was a boy, you wash your hands. And so, it's always good to have, good personal hygiene practices. And if nothing else, I think that COVID has reinforced that for a lot of people. And it's not just COVID, it's flu, and it's, the common cold and just a whole range of things. But it makes sense, especially given the high degree of transmissibility of the Delta variant. It makes sense to be, extra vigilant until that variant eventually plays out, and eventually it will. But I think that we're going to be in for, somewhat rough summer, and I think that we're going to be in for, a difficult fall. I think that one of the things that people have to understand and realize is that when we talk about a pandemic is really just a collection of localized epidemics. So if you look at a place like, Baltimore, a lot of the data that's out there is in aggregate, but Highland Town will have very different outcomes than, say, Charles Village.
just because of who lives there, the access they have to health care. You know, it's those social determinants of health are different in different areas, and that affects, you know, how this virus spreads. This virus spreads through behavior. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't use any other means. It doesn't use the subway. It doesn't use cars. It spreads by our behavior. The decisions that we make is what spreads this virus. Plain and simple.
Full I'm glad you kind of said that, because we had someone on the show earlier talking about 5G. That was a big thing that came up. People still believe that this is from the result of 5G rather than being a virus.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, I'm a data scientist, and so by nature, I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical of everything. That's my job. My job is to look at the data and look at it without passion or prejudice, right? And so when people started talking about COVID and COVID deaths and saying that deaths were misclassified, some people were saying that there were too many deaths being attributed to COVID. Some people were saying too few. I went back, and for one of my contracted counties, I looked at all of the death records for the last 7 years, every single person that died in that county last 7 years. And the reason why I did that is because I want to understand what the trends were and then look at COVID. And I looked at every single case of death for COVID. COVID only had, you know, 1 year's worth of data, not even a full year's worth of data.
Right.
But what I found was that COVID was the leading singular cause of death. More than any form of cancer, any single form of cancer, more than car accidents, more than homicides, more than really more than anything. And so the issue became one of, you know, I think about it, especially with the Black community, and we're concerned about crime and all the different all the different ways that our lives can be imperiled. And it turns out that COVID is killing, you know, especially for African Americans. We're dying at almost three times the rate of anyone else. Twice the rate of death and three times the rate of hospitalizations from COVID. So, you know, it's a serious, serious issue. And, I get the people being concerned about what they put in their bodies. We should all be concerned about what we put in our bodies, and especially around the vaccine. I've heard people say, well, the vaccine's experimental. It hasn't been approved. It's not experimental. The experimental portion was done, you know, almost a year ago when those initial clinical trials. That's the experimental phase. This is an emergency use authorization. And I would suspect that these vaccines are well on track to being approved, fully approved, more than likely within the next few months, in relatively short order. I would be surprised if you're talking September, October to actually see the FDA fully approve at least two of these vaccines, if not all three, for use.
I'm so sorry, Chuck. I mean, I have so many things I want to talk with you about. So we need to invite you back, because I want to speak in our next conversation. I want to have you talk about Moderna, Pfizer, Novavax, which I know you have, Johnson & Johnson. There's just so much more. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and just giving us just your opinion based upon your research. As you said, you look at data without prejudice or passion. You just look at what the data says as a behavioral data scientist. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. K.
So, folks, we're going to hold it here for just a second. When we come back, we have Ralph, we have Carl, and we're going to talk to somebody from the Nurses Association, because we want to hear where the nurses stand with the fact that hospitalizations are starting to go back up. Stay with us. More when we return. Well, I have two calls before I go to the National Nurses United Vice President and President of the California Nurses Association, Kathy Kennedy. I'll go with her to just a second. Let me go to Ralph first. Ralph, how are you?
can. I just want to know if the escape variant, is it some aspect of the Delta variant?
It's another mutation off of the original COVID-19. So you have the Delta, you have the Alpha, Beta, Delta. You have what he's talking about in terms of the Epsilon variant, and there's a Lambda variant, and then this new escape variant is the one they're studying now, which is able to evade vaccines.
Okay, so it's separate from the Delta variant.
Yes, it's just another mutation off of the original COVID-19.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. We have Carl on the phone. Carl, how are you?
Dr. K, you have some of the best guests and callers in the world. I'm going to go back to before the behavioral data scientist, and I think what we're experiencing right now is a crisis of trust, mm-hmm. truth, and it is all fueled by trolls.
Mm.
I mean,
like
you got
that.
People who are believing in cryptocurrency, hookah pipes, chicken boxes and fast food, but you know, it's some of this stuff they can't seem to grasp the truth. And you know, you have cell phones and computers, but it gives you access to information, but it's hard to get through all of the disinformation,
right,
to get to the bottom, to get to the truth.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem with a lot of people. And I think people also have a very limited knowledge of mathematics and statistics.
Right, I think so.
And they're rolling the dice that they can't win.
No.
And with regard to your guests, I would like to know if you could get a guy by the name of Jonathan Rauch.
Okay.
He has a book called The Constitution of Knowledge.
I like that. We will look it up.
And
so
I think he would be a great addition to your guest list.
We're taking that down now. Thank you so much. I appreciate you. Folks, I want to go now to Kathy Kennedy. She's the National Nurses United Vice President and President of the California Nurses Association. Nurse Kennedy, how are you?
I'm fine. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
So I wanted to ask you, before we talk about what's going to happen with the National Day of Action to demand patient and nurse protections, what are you seeing in the hospitals now in regards to COVID-19 hospitalizations?
Well, you know, here in California, well, across the United States, we're seeing an increase in hospitalization of COVID-positive patients. That's what we're seeing. You know, at one point, it started to drop, but within the last couple of weeks, we're seeing an increase. In fact, it's within the past 2 weeks, hospitalizations are up about 22% nationwide. And in some states, you know, it's even higher. So that's what we're seeing.
Now, I want to ask you, Nurse Kennedy, and I'm almost embarrassed to ask you this question, but I have to put it on the table. We still have some callers who don't believe that COVID-19 is real. I'm being very honest here. They called today. Could you talk about what you saw last year when we were in? Because most of us weren't in the hospital, so we have no idea what was really happening on the ground.
You know, it's even hard to understand. You know, this is a public health crisis. And what we saw a few months ago was an increase of hospitalization to the point where we were, you know, we didn't have enough ICU beds. You know, we increased the number of beds in our units. And we saw a lot of deaths, nurses that were exhausted, working extra shifts, still scrambling to make sure that they had the optimal PPE necessary to, you know, care for our very, very sick patients, as well as to protect, you know, the nurses, our loved ones, and, you know, in our community. So it was exhausting. And the nurses were, it was almost like PTSD.
Mm.
So to see this again is mind-boggling. It's very hard to understand because this pandemic hasn't gone away. And it is a public health crisis.
Now, one of the things that I don't think people really remember, but I was, you know, in preparation for my conversation with you, I went back and I looked at a number of the articles that focused on nurses last year, and there was a picture that I just said, and it just made me cry even again last night, of nurses in trash bags because they did not have enough PPE.
Yeah.
How did nurses as a whole, how did you get through that feeling that you didn't have what you needed to be able to properly and effectively do your job?
Well, you know, we sounded the alarm right when we heard about the very first case. And so hospitals had an opportunity to get ready, and they were not ready. And, you know, the thought of plastic garbage bags, you know, to work as gowns, all of those things was unbelievable. But yet, the amount of money that hospitals profited was unbelievable. So it felt like we were expendable. And, you know, and I've been a nurse for 41 years, and I've been through some pretty significant crises, but this by far tops them all.
Do you think it impacted the field in terms of people wanting to either remain as a nurse or to come into the nursing field?
You know, I think you see a little bit of both. It broke my heart when I saw young nurses that said, you know, after day after day after day, you know, doing what we do best, which is caring for patients, and then being totally exhausted and wiped out. And I remember hearing one nurse saying that you become numb. You don't feel, you can't laugh, you're numb. And so those nurses chose to leave the field of nursing. Now, like I said, I've been in nursing for 41 years, and we've gone through a number of crises since I became a nurse back in 1980. And I'm hopeful that there are still people out there that absolutely want to go into healthcare, whether it's being a registered nurse or a physician or whatever. So it's just the what we as an organization have been saying from day one, you know, to really pay attention to the precautionary principle, make sure that healthcare workers and registered nurses have what they need to care for our sickest of patients, and making sure that our nurses and healthcare workers are safe so that they don't contract this virus and take it home to their family members and our communities.
So I know I'm so glad you said that, because I have such a fondness for nurses. As the granddaughter of one of the first Black nurses in South Carolina, my grandmother, I have such respect for the field, and I know every time I've been sick, it's the nurses who do the hands-on touch with you. I know their names, and even if you don't know the name of the doctor. So I thank you for your service and your ministry to us during a very difficult time last year. I know that one of the things that you want to talk about today is about the National Day of Action that's demanding patient and nurse protections. Can you talk about this National Day of Action and talk about why we are now at the point where nurses today are going forward and saying we need more protections for ourselves and for our patients?
Well, I mean, you know, just take a look at what has happened over the last 18 months. Not only did we lose over 600,000 people here in the United States, but there was a large number of healthcare workers, including registered nurses. I think we lost over, I don't even know the number, 400 plus registered nurses across the United States. So it's clear, you know, I mean, that, like I said, from day one, it has been the nurses that have been in the forefront talking about precautionary principle, ensuring that when we take care of our sickest of patients, not only do we have the optimal PPE that is necessary, and the fact that we shouldn't be reusing, you know, N95 respirators and albeit even gowns for that matter. And we need more staff. During the COVID, what we saw was some employers actually laying off registered nurses. you know, cutting contracts of travel nurses because they felt that it wasn't needed. And they made a profit. So we're here to say we need to ensure that we can provide safe patient care to our sickest of patients. And we are demanding that not only do we have the PPE that's necessary and that it's not under lock and key, but we also have the staff that we need to ensure that every patient that walks through our doors has access to quality, safe patient care. So we're out there, and we're not going to stop.
So now I know that one of the demands that you have, and I, you know, I call them demands. This is what I have here on the paper in bold. So one of your demands is one, by the way, I'm in complete support of. I support the nurses.
Yes.
I never stop
Thank
clapping
you.
For you. Let me just say,
yes.
I see
yeah.
you as heroes and heroes. But one of your demands is to reinstate the recommendation for everyone to wear masks when in public or in physical proximity to others outside their own household. For some reason, that seems to be, and this may be from your perspective, but the battleground in this country, which I thought, Nurse Kennedy, would be over race or over class, over gender, that the battleground is over masks and a vaccine, which is just incredible to me. Can you talk about the push to get the mask mandates reinstated?
Well, again, this pandemic has not gone away. And it's pretty clear at what has just happened, you know. I mean, I heard your last caller and talking about, you know, the Delta variant is out there. And it's prevalent. And it is because we don't have enough people vaccinated. And, you know, again, it's important that, you know, those of us that are vaccinated, we need to make sure that we're also protecting people, and the unvaccinated folks need to wear masks and social distance and continue to do the hygiene. It's so important. And it's because of this Delta variant, variant, it's important because even, you know, vaccinated people can become infected and can spread the virus. So it's important until we get a handle on this, get more people vaccinated. You know, we really want to make sure that, you know, the importance of masking.
Okay, how about updating the healthcare infection control to fully recognize aerosol transmission? So I thought we had done that.
It's important that, again, you said we've done that, but we continue to have to, force the employer to do the right thing. We can't let up. And so that means that we want anybody that comes into the hospital to be tested, COVID tested, before they enter into the hospital. And if they are positive, we do the protections that's necessary. Put them in an isolation room. Make sure that the nurses and other healthcare professionals have the optimal PPE that is necessary so that they can care for the patient and that we don't spread this virus within the hospital. So we continue to fight. You know, yes, you know, it may be, you know, done. The implementation part and the enforcement is what we need to really hold the employer's feet to the fire. And that's an ongoing issue throughout the United States.
And so I just have two more questions for you, Nurse
sure.
Kennedy, the National Nurses United Vice President and President of the California Nurses Association. My first question is, as a nurse, you said 41 years as a nurse, coming
yes.
through working every day during COVID-19, we are now, in some people's mind, out of this global pandemic, and you and I know that we're not. When you think about COVID-19, what keeps you up at night when you think about this virus?
Well, you know, what keeps me up at night is this, is that this is a public health crisis. And, you know, it's important for people to understand that means everybody, not just in the United States, but globally. And we need to get the right information out to people. It is so important. You know, think about, you know, those the number of unvaccinated people. We need to continue to educate those that, you know, choose not to, or maybe because of the misinformation that they get, that they're not vaccinated. I think it's important to provide good, solid scientific information to people. And, you know, with the schools, you know, getting ready to open up, you know, and we're not providing vaccinations, you know, from 12 and up.
Right.
We have kids going back to school. And it's important that we, you know, I'm a grandmother and I have children and grandkids, and I want to make sure that everyone is protected. And the best way to do that is make sure that the parents are protected.
Right.
Everybody wear a face mask, whether you're vaccinated or not. Continue your socially distancing, hand washing, all those things until we can get beyond this. So that's what keeps me up at night,
yeah.
But I still get up and go to work.
I know you do. I have my last question for you. Over in France, they're now requiring citizens to carry some type of vaccine passport. Any events that have more than 50 people, you got to show the pass that you've been vaccinated. Concerts, big restaurants. Do you think that America, and I know we are the land of the free, home of the brave, right? You know, we're free
yes,
to do
we
our
are.
Own thing, right? Which I completely support, except... I'm wondering, do you think we need to look at doing some type of mandate around this so that we can get more people vaccinated or have a passport? So that way, if you want to move around, have you been vaccinated? Have you done your part?
Well, let me say this. You know, as a nurse, I don't think that I can really answer that question because really, as a registered nurse, as nurses, we are about the public,
mm-hmm.
and this is a public health crisis. I think the first, what we need to constantly do, and we're not stopping, is educate. Model yourself by wearing a mask, socially distancing, all those things. You know, my grandkids know. They wear a mask, they wash their hands. I mean, and it's wonderful to see that. And when they're of age and are able to get vaccinated, I'm hoping that their parents will, you know, get them vaccinated.
Right.
But we need to first provide that education and get rid of this fear mongering that's happening. So I don't want to speak about mandates. It's important to educate.
And then, of course, do more COVID testing.
Absolutely.
Because that has gone down a lot.
Testing. Testing anybody that comes through our doors that's going to be admitted to the hospital. Absolutely. Test the nurses and other healthcare workers on a regular basis.
Wow.
You know, it's there, but we've got to continue to tell the employer, what are you doing? You know?
Yeah.
It needs to happen.
I completely appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Oh,
Nurse
you're quite
Kathy
welcome.
Kennedy, it has been a pleasure. Thank you for your ministry.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
And be safe.
You too. So, folks, I want to open up the phone lines. We have had these conversations today about COVID-19 that really started with the conversation about Dr. Fauci and whether or not he was credible. I agree with what Clarence said. Don't put Dr. Fauci and Dr. Kazmikia Corbett in the same sentence. I get that because Sister Girl was rocking and rolling. I want to just throw out this other story. We only have a little bit of time left, so I just want to give you a teaser of this story. I have a clip about what happened when a white Alabama councilman urged to reassign after he asked a question regarding the N-word. So I know Dre cut this and made sure that it's all clean and ready to go. So why don't we take a listen to it, then we'll open up, because race is always an issue. Let's take a listen to it.
I mean,
hey,
I know I'm black.
Hey, do we have?
How do you want to address what I have to say?
Do we have a house in here?
Yeah, you.
Okay.
Do we? Hey,
yeah,
do we? Would she please stand up?
Yeah, I was seeing this, right?
So the dude is up in there. And he is asking, and I'm laughing because it's just ridiculous. That's what I'm saying. It is 2021. When people tell me that you don't know that the N-word is not something we say in 2021, all I can do is laugh and say, you know what? You must think that I'm stupid because I'm not. I may not know everything, but I do know that thing. I do know that listening to a councilman, a white councilman, asking the question about whether there's a house N-word in the place. Tommy Bryant is a white Tarrant City councilman. He used a racial epithet during a council meeting on Monday. Do we have a house N-word? word in here? Brian asked during the recorded council meeting. Do we? Do we? He said he was simply repeating what the mayor had called a fellow councilman in executive session. He said the mayor, and the mayor's name, of course, is Mayor Wayman Newton. He said Mayor Wayman called a fellow council member, Veronica Freeman. Now, they don't say the races of Wayman and Veronica, but I'm just thinking, if Wayman called Veronica a house in, and Wayman was able to walk out of that meeting, Wayman and Veronica are probably people of color. They probably black. I'm just saying. I'm just going to make this up. I don't know for certain, but I'm thinking if we're in executive session and you turn to me at a table and you call me the house N-word, so it's a double slur, right? So the first slur is the N-word, and I think we're all clear. Like Farisha Day said, that the N-word is the racial, what is this, the nuclear bomb of racial epithets. We know that when someone calls you the N-word, those are fighting words. I mean, I know we want to talk about N-I-G-G-A versus N-I-G-G-E-R. You know what? N-I-G-G-E-R, those are fighting words. If you're going to step to my face and you're going to call me that, that means you're ready to throw hands. Now, you're probably saying, well, Dr. K, you're all into love and peace. I am. I'm into love and peace. I'm not into violence. I am into the peace movement. I'm into finding peaceful solutions. I'm also not into you calling me the N-word in my face. But if you add in the word house in front of the N-word, it's a double slur. Why? Because in the black community, we have been led, I'm going to say it's not true, we've been led to believe that black folks who were enslaved and worked in the house were someone that's some way more aligned to the plantation owner than black folks who worked in the field. Except, this is a lie they told us, right? They're working in the house. Things must be easy. You know, Mr. Boss Man, are we sick today? We're working together. I'm going to tell on the people in the field. What ends up happening, if you look at the research and look at the story, those that worked in the house actually worked longer hours than those that worked in the field. Those that worked in the field worked from sunup to sundown. But when the sun went down, you went back to your cabin, back to your family unit. You had a little bit of peace away from the plantation owner. There were a number of people who were enslaved who had their own gardens. They would knit. They would crochet. They would sing songs. Sometimes they'd go away to the woods and they would have church. I'm not saying that life was perfect, but you didn't have the plantation owner's boot on your neck all day and all night like you did when you lived in the house. If you lived in the house adjacent to the big house, you were always on duty and always on call. I told you, they started working enslaved boys as early as 4 years old, that your job was to be the footstool for the plantation owners, to go and get water. They had seven-year-old boys. Your job was to sit by the bed of the plantation owner and wake them up at a certain point so they can go to the bathroom. They had enslaved girls working in the house early on, learning how to, you know, churn the butter, move this, learning how to sew. You were constantly in service where you had no peace away from the plantation owner. But the house inn has become a slur. See, this is how they tell us our history. This is how they lead us to believe that there were layers and that people had it better. If you were enslaved, no matter where you were on that stratum, you were property. That includes Sally Hemings all the way down. Someone owned you on paper and therefore could move you around at will. Here are two things I want to throw out, which I think are really fascinating in the research that I've been doing, because I've been looking a lot at slavery and justice over the last couple of weeks with this book that I'm working on. One is that when people wanted to buy an enslaved man, woman, or child, they would take out a mortgage. Like you take out a mortgage on your house. You know, you take out a mortgage on your house, and it's a 30-year mortgage, and if you really have money, you do 15 years, and sometimes it's 20 years. They would take out a mortgage on enslaved people. So if I wanted to buy an enslaved man, woman, and child, and I didn't have enough money, I took out a mortgage, and I made payments every year off of their labor to pay off my debt. Here's a second piece I think is very interesting. You know how when you take out your life insurance, so if something happens to you, you want to make sure that your family's taken care of. You got your car insurance, which is a ripoff in my opinion. But if something happens, you know, once you pay your deductible again, you then can get things covered. They had insurance on enslaved bodies. So that way, if I buy an enslaved man and he doesn't work hard enough, or he breaks his leg or breaks his foot or he dies early, I've got an insurance policy on him and I can get paid. These are the stories about the truth of our history that they don't want us to teach in school and they don't want us to talk about. So when he said, is there a house in the world, in the room, there were layers to what he was saying. We're going to pick this conversation up tomorrow. Tomorrow, I want to have a deep dive conversation about what parenting looks like in the age of COVID, what we can do differently, and why we have to be prepared to teach culturally responsive teaching from our kitchen table if necessary. This is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Thank you so much to Justina Pollard, my producer, and to Andre Melton running the board. Stay here for Two-Way Talk with Anthony McCarthy and Kara Williams after the break.